Okay, so everyone ready for the next step? Okay. So Chris was covering the introduction of CTMM, and now I'm going to be covering actually how to do the home range estimation part. So I'll zoom back a little bit and revisit some of the themes that we were talking about, and then we can actually get into the home range estimation. So it's important to consider that a home range, right, is essentially the outcome of the interplay between various connecting themes, right? We have the interplay between the environment, an animal's understanding of that environment, and also any subsequent movement decisions within that environment, right? So there's always the environmental context, the social context, and then what the animal is able to do, where is able to move, and how is able to move there. So this home range behavior, home ranging behavior, is essentially a prevalent use that we have, a prevalent pattern in space use. And even Darwin noticed that animals tend to not needlessly wander around, right? They have their proper homes. So this is a concept that has been around for a long time, and people are aware of it. And like Chris was showing up earlier, this idea of essentially area-restricted space use behavior. If you have the brain in motion, this was one on the right that immediately disappeared and went off to another area, right? But we are here, especially if we're considering home range, it's an animal that stays within a restricted area. So this is very important to consider. Yeah, so home range as defined by Bert the first time, as the area traversed by the individual in its normal activities of food gathering, mating, and caring for young. And occasionally, Sally is outside the area, perhaps exploratory in nature, should not be considered part of the home range. So this has been essentially the concept that has driven a lot of people to study home range and try to see how we can actually get a statistically reliable estimate out of it. One of the points from Bert's paper is that this idea of home range is different than the idea of territory, right? While as a home range is not actively defended, a territory is the area within the home range that's actively defended. So it's something to keep in mind. We are not trying to estimate territories. We're trying to estimate just the general area of this normal activities. So this definition brings up a few different questions, right? How do we quantify this home range area? And what constitutes this exploratory movement, right? And how can we identify these exploratory movements? So it's a key portion of this concept from Bert. But in practice, as I'm sure you know, it's hard to define when a move is pure exploratory, especially if you're just looking at locations on a map, right? So it's difficult to know, is the animal actually going out, exploring an area, deciding I don't like it, I'm gonna go back, or if there's something in that area that actually has some resource, some high use resource that the animal needs. So this is a very difficult question to really answer properly. And typically what people do is that they exclude these infrequent outlying points, like essentially outliers, it's outlier locations from this home range definition, even if we don't know exactly if it's purely exploratory or not. So here and from essentially from now on, I'm focusing on this definition here, right? Which is a little bit more detailed. It's the home range as the area repeatedly used throughout an animal's lifetime for its normal behaviors and activities, and excluding occasional exploratory excursions. And this idea of lifetime space use is what's important here, right? The spatial temporal scale that we are considered here and wanting to focus on is this. We want to be able to capture as much as possible this birth to death space use. Obviously, it's not always realistic in the field to be able to track an animal from birth to death. So we want to just try to approximate that, right? We want to be able to do that as much as possible. And what's important as well is that, again, this definition here is essentially expecting to include future locations. So this is when Chris was showing that, simulated buffalo and rights where the animal, you think, oh, maybe it's not using this area. Eventually, if you kept simulating it, right, it would eventually use that area. And that's kind of the question here. Sometimes what you're seeing in the data is just essentially one portion of that birth to death, right? And you want to make sure that you're able to get a better, bigger picture. And especially if you think about it for conservation, that's very important. Right, so in time of birth, it was basically like, let's go out, we have a map, and we are basically seeing where the animal is and placing it on a map. So it makes sense that one of the first methods that show up was this minimum convex polygon, right? It was easier to just by hand create this polygon shape and calculate the area, right? But very quickly, they realized that there's something here, you know, that to actually get an understanding of the biological significance of an animal's home range, you must include some knowledge of the intensity of use, right? It's not just about getting the general extent of where the animal is. We want an idea of, you know, high intensity use versus low intensity use. And the first time this idea of intensity of use was introduced in movement ecology with the kernel density estimator by Vorten in 1989, which was the year I was born, so just from perspective when that was showed up. So we can use this home range area estimates to inform many things, different conservation outputs, right? If we're trying to delineate a protected area and we want to know if it's enough to for a minimal area requirement for a certain species or a certain group of individuals, home range areas is one of the things we're using for that, right? Any land use decisions of in terms of if that needs to be a change in how a certain area is managed, and any conservation policy and initiatives, right? Even those related to human-wildlife conflict, which is why, once again, it's important to capture this animal's lifetime area. Right, so obviously, like I was saying earlier, we're not necessarily going to be able to track it from birth to death. We are just tracking it for a portion of its lifetime, usually. So how representative is this period, right? Is the movement behavior stationary enough during that movement period that we can actually do all the analysis that we're going to be looking into today? And just as an example, so this is the data from King Cobra, a project I was working on. This is from Thailand. And this is essentially the boundary of a protected area, a biosphere reserve, right? So we can see this is the locations for 1 year of VHF tracking data for one of the individuals. And obviously, we can see that it was using area within the protected area and also going on some occasional ventures outside, right? So obviously, especially considering that this is a venomous snake, we're interested in understanding this human-wildlife conflict potential and if these areas outside of the protected area are important enough to be featured within the home range and if that's a concern for how we deal with this in the field, right? So obviously, if we do a home range estimate over this individual, we do know that it is going outside, and these areas are equally as important for the animal, right? So, but the thing to consider here is that we went out, we collected data for 1 year, right? So what if we only done it for 6 months? Imagine the animal died within 6 months of data collection. So within the first 6 months, so I just subsetted the data for the first 6 months, it always stayed within the protected area, right? So if by chance, when we went out, we collected the data, the animal died, and maybe we would have seen this, and our idea would be, okay, maybe they never go out of the protected area, right? So there was never potential for wildlife, human conflict in this scenario. And as we were seeing, as you were seeing earlier with Chris, and we'll go over it a little bit again, this idea of the variogram and trying to understand really, is it capturing this process in a way that's significant? Is essentially targeting this potential case, right? You want to make sure that this is not happening with your data, that you're getting enough representation of this tracking duration that it can be a good, reliable estimate of the home range. So obviously there's plenty of methods in the literature to estimate home range. One of, like I was showing earlier, the minimum convex polygon, it's very common, it's still used, and you can find it in papers sometimes, especially for comparative purposes and some niche times where you can use them. But essentially assumes uniform use, assumes locations are independent, and essentially is sensitive to any outliers and point geometry, right? And obviously there's always the problem of accounting for areas that are not necessarily being used by the animal. So that's what the kernel density estimator was trying to fix a little bit by describing not just this extent of an area of use, but going beyond it and the intensity of use, right, the probability of use. So it's very basic the way it kind of works in the background. At each location, you create this three-dimensional hill, which is the kernel. And it's the shape of width of the kernel, which essentially is based on this bandwidth H value that kind of determines how wide or how narrow it is, right? So lower bandwidth values mean it's more intensely used at this point and doesn't go much further, while higher H values do a little bit more over-smoothing. And then basically, you just average all those kernels and you get an idea of the density estimation of your locations. So it's very, very simple the way it's working in the background. But here what's important to consider is what is that H, right? Which was talked a little bit yesterday as well, this idea of the bandwidth and how we can optimally select it. As we can see, this H value has a big influence in the probability, the intensity of use, right? So if you start looking at different bandwidth values, going from very small to very large comparatively, you can see that it can change very quickly what's the intensity of use of a certain area, right? So here, it's just kind of staying very closely, tightly connected to the location. So that's basically saying, the only areas of intensity of use are where my location was, and then you get further and further until the point where maybe everywhere is important, right? And this selection of the H value in the literature has plenty of different algorithms that are used. And obviously, it means that this method is very sensitive to this bandwidth selection. In the literature, typically you see this Gaussian reference function, GFR or href, and it kind of makes it look a little bit like this, a bit of over-smoothing, but sometimes has issues, as you can see here with this area here when the animal goes a bit outside. But it tends to over-smooth a little bit more than some of the other ones like the LSCV, which is the one that basically tightly conforms to the locations, right? But yeah, so the problem specifically with the LSCV, which is sometimes you still see being used in the literature, is that it actually performs worse with larger sample sizes. So the better data you have, the worse this model or this method performs with your data. And obviously, it still doesn't account for autocorrelation. That's kind of the problem there. That's why it's doing this. Even though it's attempting to kind of fix some of the issues of the previous bandwidth selection methods, it kind of goes too much on the other side, right? So, yeah.
I was curious what exactly they're cross-validating with the least squares cross-validation.
Sorry?
I was always curious what is actually being validated with this LSCV method. I've always been curious what...
I think it's trying to minimize the square distance between, locations. So it's... I'm not sure exactly, like, the details of how it works in the background.
Yeah, neither am I. So, yeah. I mean, presumably, so this is my best guess is it's taking out like a, you know, maybe multiple times, taking out a portion of the, it just does it so fast. I don't know what the actual algorithm is.
Yeah,
but it must be removing some data. Mm-hmm. It must be getting a kernel. It must be seeing how, you know, how much of the remaining data gets mm-hmm. captured by the, mm-hmm. anyways, I've always yeah. wondered.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense because it's leave one out, right? So it's probably something related to that, but I don't know the details, no.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Yeah, so typically the way you do this is by thinning the data, right? To apply these methods because, again, it assumes independence. So this is what we'd have to do. This is one, just a data set with the number of locations around 2,000. And to actually achieve independence for this, you'd have to remove enough that you basically only get 30 locations, like a data loss of 70. Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, all of the most common bandwidth optimizers for KDE, they're all approximating the mean integrated square error between the true unknown distribution and the KDE. But unlike doing a regression, where the truth is just the model at some parameters, since this is non-parametric, you don't have the truth. So you can't ever evaluate the mean integrated square error loss function exactly, so you have to do an approximation. And all the different bandwidth optimizers correspond to different approximations of this one formula. And the least squares cross validation corresponds to an approximation where you're removing one point and then summing over all cases where you remove that one point. It's just an approximate formula for the... It's a little more abstract than that because it's like a mathematical approximation to the mean integrated square error, but it does involve removing one point, calculating a bunch of stuff, and then going to the next point, removing that point, calculating a bunch of stuff. There's another cross-validation technique where you remove a point and look at the coverage. And it's more like concrete, but it's slower and less used.
Yeah, so if you try to thin the data with this amount of loss, right, then what's the point of going out and collecting so much data if you could just do less, right? So it seems a bit counterproductive to like go through the process of spending the time collecting the data and then having to thin it just to apply these methods. And also, essentially, how confident are we on these estimates anyway? And as Chris was saying, especially with this conventional kernel density estimator, it does have the issue of as your body mass of the study species increases, the accuracy of this method is lower, right? Because of the issues related to the actual method. And even if you see on the other plots, the relocations included, this is the same thing that Chris was showing when you only look at the first half of the data and then you see how it reflects the second half of the data, so it's the relocation percentage included, it also decreases, right? The ability to capture that full picture of the home range. And as we've seen, animal movement is autocorrelated, and this is informative, right? This is information that we want to stay in the data because it tells us something about it. If you look at this, if we have here the elevation map of the US, if the features were not autocorrelated, it would basically be like this. And this has absolutely no meaning, right? So autocorrelation is important. As it was also discussed a little bit yesterday, because sometimes you still see in the literature this brain and branch movement models being used to estimate home range. But is it really estimating home range? And as we've seen, it's not, right? Because there's this difference between the range distribution and the occurrence distribution, right? Range distribution being that you're trying to extrapolate into the future, right? This idea of lifetime, of getting more than just the sampling period. While occurrence distribution, we are interpolating between data points, right? So the questions that you ask and you're trying to answer, and if you're interested in different things, maybe it's better for you to look at range distribution methods, maybe it's better for you to look at occurrence distribution methods. So for example, obviously, if you're interested in home range area or population range area, or any of the questions that I was asking earlier about conservation outputs related to protected areas, that's the range distribution. If you're looking at occurrence distribution, which we'll go over a little bit later today, we are asking questions like, where did the animal cross a linear feature, like a road or some area that you're of interest? How likely it is to visit a location, because it gives you essentially a value of the probability the animal passed through an area. How much time did it spend in a specific habitat as well? Are all questions you can answer with occurrence distribution methods. And the BMM, like we saw, is an occurrence distribution, not a range distribution. So always be aware of that. You cannot use it for purposes of home range estimation. And as we can see here, so the difference here is essentially the sampling interval going for 4 locations a day to 1 location per day and then 1 location per week. And as we can see, both of these bandwidth selection methods, the Gaussian reference and the LSCV, they change very, sometimes very dramatically, depending on the sampling interval. So they're not sampling independent. The MCP, obviously the pending may look a little bit more stable, but then as we see, especially in this case, it's accounting for an area that maybe it's not used by the animal, but again, it has other problems beyond just sampling independence. Yeah, and as Chris was just telling us, the idea is to minimize this mean integrated square error with respect to the bandwidth, so the square difference between the estimated location, or sorry, the estimated density and the true density. And obviously, since we don't know the true density, we're trying to estimate this mean integrated square error, which means that basically depends very rapidly on the bandwidth optimizer. But yeah, so the bandwidth is essentially there's not a true value of age, of bandwidth that reflects your animal. So it's not saying like your species or your animal has an age value of this, and this is always going to be the case, right? It's the what you're trying to choose correctly here is the bandwidth optimizer, not the bandwidth value itself. Okay, so for this workflow of getting to the point where we get a home range estimation, the first step is looking at the range residency assumption, checking if an animal is range resident or not, right? And this is where maybe I'll lose some of you in terms of are you going to apply this method to your data or not? Because basically, in most cases, for CTMM methods, and especially for a home range estimation within CTMM, you kind of have to have this range residency assumption fulfilled. So in most cases, if you have a migratory or nomadic species, it's difficult to get a good estimate and a biologically meaningful estimates out of this home range. So typically, we're more focused on range residency species. And as we saw, the way to kind of measure and visualize this autocorrelation with the variogram. Again, Chris covered some of this. I'm just going to quickly go over it again. Where essentially it plots the time lags on the XY axis and then against the semivariance, which is the average square distance between any given two locations, right? So any locations that are that far apart in time are used for that. And obviously, the more similar the present locations are, the lower the semivariance is going to be. So typically, you see that ideally, there's a tapering off, essentially, a reaching an asymptote. And that's what we want, because that's what it means. Basically, the animal reached the point of range residency confirmation. But obviously there are cases, and this would be what the Bernier motion would show, is that the animal just keeps expanding and going further and further away, and the variogram would keep increasing as well. So we can see as we collect more and more data, eventually the variogram kind of stabilizes, right? Okay, so once we have the confirmation of range residency, the next step is to select the best fit movement models through model selection. Again, this is where the big difference between the conventional methods and the continuous time methods come into play. It's because there's the step of fitting a movement model before estimating the home range. We're not making any assumptions. We're trying to figure out what movement process of the ones that are available to us can actually explain my animal movement better. So these are the ones currently available within CTMM. And the good thing about CTMM is that if there's a new method that comes out that explains something better, can be added very quickly to and again, it can always expand and include more variations of this. So maybe if you have a very different movement, we'll look into it and add it to CTMM if we can. So obviously the independent and internally distributed, essentially assuming independence, this is what will happen if in some cases, back in the day, which was what made some methods still be able to work very well, like the MCPs and kernel density estimators. If you sample once a month, maybe your data will be independent, so it doesn't really matter. You can use an MCP and a kernel and still get a decent estimate in comparison because you're fulfilling the assumptions. So it's essentially like, again, there's no autocorrelation in your data. And as we saw, the IID process, the independent and identically distributed, is basically that shape of increases very quickly and then just does a line. So if you see this in your semi-variograms, it basically means that your data is independent. For the Bernier motion, you have essentially the stochastic process that just basically has no bounds, right? It just keeps diffusing constantly across space. And the way it would look like in the variogram is, like I said, it would just keep increasing because there's always correlation in the positions. And then there's the essentially the modifications to the Bernier motion, the OU, the IOU, and the OUF. The OU, like Bernier motion, it does tend toward the situ location again, so it does have this range residency assumption. The IOU, the integrated OU, doesn't have that bounded diffusion, but it does have persistence of motion, so the animal does tend to have some directional persistence in the points. And for the OUF, it has both, right? It's bounded and it has the persistence of motion. So for the OU, the difference here is that you'd see, because both the OU and the OUF, they kind of taper off and they show the range residency assumption. The OU has no essentially velocity autocorrelation. That first part of the variogram doesn't show a curve upwards. Well, the OU would show that curve, but then it would not taper off. It would have unbounded. And yeah, and the OUF, yeah, it has both. Okay, so this is basically just a summary of what I've been talking about, mostly for you guys to have afterwards if you need a quick check and see what the different models can be easily compared. But something here to remember is that, and I really like this phrase, that all models are wrong, but some are useful, right? It's always cases where the model is not necessarily exactly what your data is, but maybe it's useful for something, and it reflects something that you can actually look. So just don't expect it to be exactly the same and fit perfectly, because that's very rarely gonna happen with real data. And just for the record, because you see it sometimes in the movement when you're comparing the different processes, and it shows up with the isotropic or anisotropic. It's basically just this diffusion, the different types of diffusion, right? If it's isotropic, diffuses equally towards all directions. If it's anisotropic, it's a directional process, or the direction dependent, right? Just so you can visualize it a little bit better. So when we're doing this fitting of the movement models, in the background, CTMM is essentially just trying to figure out what's the way to actually get the best parameters that best characterize my given tracking data set. And this is where maximum likelihood comes into play, and the different, essentially different estimators that can be used to it. This was already talked a little bit, but yeah, so essentially the maximum likelihood, we're trying to select the parameters that make the observed data most probable. The difference here with maximum likelihood is that it performs purely at small sample sizes, right? So if you have very few data points, depending where those data points land, the maximum likelihood estimation compared to the true distribution might not have the mean in the right place, right? Because again, it's the defective sample size, the low sample size problem here with maximum likelihood. But if you have a lot of data, you have large sample sizes, maximum likelihood can be slightly faster to run, so it could be still ideally to use. But yeah, we'll look into it a little bit as well in the code when we're running through it. Another one that we can use besides the maximum likelihood is this residual maximum likelihood, right? The idea here is we're kind of doing a trade-off, right? We're losing reducing bias by increasing the variability, like assuming that there's more variation in the parameters than maximum likelihood. So it's a kind of a way to fix some of the problems with maximum likelihood. And as we'll see, Chris has developed some better ways of actually getting this that also accounts for small effective sample sizes. So we'll discuss that a little bit more later on. And what's important here as well throughout this whole process is to distinguish between two ideas of sample size, the absolute sample size and the effective sample size. So the absolute sample size, very simple. It's basically your total number of locations, right? And it's basically dependent on how long the animal is tracked for, the sampling duration, and how frequently the locations are collected, right? The sampling frequency. Meanwhile, for effective sample size, and we're going to focus here on the effective sample size for area, though there's also for speed that we can look into later. But for area, it's roughly estimated as the sampling duration divided by these tau p, which is what Chris was showing, this home range crossing time, right? The position autocorrelation parameter. And just to have a better idea, the idea is like essentially how long it takes for an animal to traverse the linear extent of its home range, right? And that's the home range crossing time scale parameter. So as this value increases, the animal, as you can see, starts very quickly covering its home range area, right? It's just very quickly going over. And this is why you get more like higher effective sample sizes, because you get a lot of repetitions of that crossing time scale. And obviously, as this value increases, the animal is taking their sweet time across the home range and being slower. So the effective sample size will decrease from there to here. And this problem with the effective sample size can be very tricky, especially for certain species. So there's this case of the Mongolian gazelles. So this is an individual that was tracked for around a year, or more than a year, and the sampling frequency of around one location every 5 hours. So it ended up with an absolute sample size of around 700 locations. And if you think about it, for most species, you think, okay, I have data for a year, I should have a pretty good idea of where the animal is going and what it's doing and the home range estimate that you can get out of it. So this is how it actually looks like, the points and the area estimate that we're getting out of it, around 300,000 square kilometers. The problem here, though, is that when we look at the actual movement process and the information that we're getting out of it, is that we realize that this home range crossing time, the tau p, is around 141 days for this particular individual. So it takes 141 days for the animal to cross. So as you saw in the animation, it's basically it's going very slowly across its home range. So that's, as you can see already from the idea of that rough estimate, if we divide the duration, the tracking duration for the by the tau p, and especially if we look at the effective sample size, it's only 2.7 locations, right? So even if we have a year of data, it might not necessarily mean much. So it's very important to consider effective sample size and be aware of it once you're running your data with this method. Because in this case, if we have 2.7 of effective sample size, it's to getting to the point where maybe there's some mitigation measures that we need to apply to kind of fix it a little bit. And we'll also go through it, because obviously there's some ways within CTMM we can kind of get a better estimate, even in these cases where we have very, very low effective sample sizes. But even smaller than this, if you have like effective sample sizes below this, then you can't really do much. No matter what you use, there's just no way to get a good estimate. Yeah.
Microphone. So if we have this low number of the effective sample estimation, when we are selecting the models, like when we run the code to select which is the best model, is it gonna select already the best model for us, or we like really need to check this information and maybe do something else?
Not during the model selection part, no. No, the best, when you're doing the CTMM select and you get the best fit, right? It's already doing the best model that can reflect your data. And that's the effective sample size from that is just basically, okay, this is how well we are able to get the estimates out of it. So the essentially any mitigation measure is after that point. It's not during model selection.
How do you actually calculate that tau p?
Sorry?
That, like, time required to cross the home range. How do you calculate that?
How do you calculate that? I mean, it's calculated with when we're doing the CTMM, the model selection, it's calculating the effective sample size from that.
No, I mean, you are also
from the parameters.
You're also estimating the home range size as well as you are calculating the time required to cross it, like how do you sum?
Yeah, because it's getting an estimate of the time scale autocorrelation parameter, so you actually know what to fit, right? So that's the autocorrelation parameters, which is the tau p, is already getting from that. If I don't understand your question.
From the model.
Yes.
Okay, so you actually don't need to know the home range size or anything.
No, it's estimating it already in the when you're doing the model selection. Yeah. Yeah, you don't need to do it. It's not on you to get this this value. Okay, so typically for independent data, you'll see that your absolute sample size will always be your effective sample size, right? It's the same, because that's kind of the idea here with the effective sample size is essentially the statistically independent locations. But for autocorrelation, your absolute size is always going to be larger, if not many times larger, than your effective sample size. But yeah, we'll go over ways of dealing with low effective sample sizes. Okay, so now that we have the best fit, we would reconstruct the actual range distribution and get this home range. And that's where the autocorrelated kernel density estimator comes in, which is basically the method developed by Chris. It's essentially in the background. It's using the kernel density estimator still, but it's not assuming anything about the data, right? Essentially, we are able to, with the model selection, know which movement model fits your data the best, then use that to inform the home range estimation. So there's no assumptions there being made. So this is just an example of an AKDE for an individual that has a sampling duration of a year, with this tau p being around 2.4 months. And this would be essentially the conventional KDE for the same, essentially the same data and exactly the same. And as we can see, there's some areas where the autocorrelated KDE is considering that the conventional KDE is not considering. And sometimes you might be thinking, this is, again, related to the same topic that's been brought up a few times. Like, is this area actually being used by the animal? Is the animal visiting this area enough that it's important, right? And once again, I'm just hiding half of the data here for you guys so you make sure, in this case, once we have the 2 years of data instead of just one, we see that the animal did go to those areas, right? So it's important to always consider the fact that if you're using the conventional methods, you might be missing out on this future use. Yeah.
So in this case, the tau p is 2.4 months, so it is still having an effective size very low, correct?
Yeah. It's still relatively low. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I don't remember exactly the average that we get. I think it's on the scale of days, typically for some species, scale of weeks for other species. And then you have obviously the case where you have months, if not more, like the Mongolian gazelle that has, 100-something days of a home range crossing time. And the good thing to also consider here is that if you actually have data that's independent, so you think, okay, I can just use the conventional KDE, you can in that case because you have independence. But the good thing is that the AKDE reduces to the conventional KDE. So if you apply the same methods within CTMM and you have independence, it would still give you the same output that the conventional KDE would do. Obviously, with also confidence intervals, which is very important, but it would reduce to that. So you don't need to go, oh, my data is independent, I'm going to use a different method. It's all incorporated within that. Yeah, so essentially the difference, besides giving us this confidence intervals, obviously the bigger your effective sample size here, represented here with the N, the comparatively to essentially a smaller effective sample size, it essentially more tightly conform between the confidence intervals, right, and the actual estimate. So if you have a very, very high effective sample size, this essentially would get closer and closer. So it'd be a good way to also, if you once you plot it, you can see how confident you are about your estimates. Oh, there's a question.
Just to be clear, the methods we use to calculate KDE, like before, mm-hmm. do they provide confidence intervals or?
The ones within CTMM, yes.
But the ones we learned before?
No.
Okay.
No. So another case here with the, as you should all be very familiar with the African buffalo data set at this point. And basically this one, it's following the OUF, the on-scene removed back with foraging. And it has an effective sample size of around 22 locations, which is still not too bad. Again, it's only getting problematic if you go below 5. So 22 is still, we're still within an acceptable, reliable estimate range. And this would still be the difference between the conventional KDE and the autocorrelated KDE, right, with an underestimation from the conventional KDE of around 40%. And again, you might be thinking it's still maybe going too far over the locations, right? And maybe it's still, you want it to conform more tightly with the data. I don't know, some people might seem to be, right? You might think, okay, maybe there's something here that's still kind of over-smoothing it too much. But again, remember, we're only looking at an effective sample size of 22 locations, right? And that's, you should always focus on the effective sample size, not the absolute sample size. Okay, so this is essentially the same trick I was showing before. Let me see how much would I have to lose to get independence. I'll have to remove 99% of the data until I reached independence, which is quite a lot. But then if you did that and you apply a conventional KDE, it's closer, right? There's the estimates are closer now. But again, what's the point of thinning the data if you don't have to? It's just an extra step that you're doing for no reason. Okay, so now we'll be going over the actual coding of it and how to get the home range estimates. Maybe we can start just to set up and make sure everything is working, and then I think lunch is in noon?
In 10 minutes.
In 10 minutes, okay. So maybe you can just make sure that the code is working and running, and then we can break for lunch. Okay, so I put the code already also in the folder. It's very similar to the code Chris has on the GitHub, but you can just get it from the folder as well, because I put it all there, so it's easier.
So which one is it? Is it DMM 2 on range?
Yeah.
On the
shared folder? Yeah. Okay, there's some objects that have already been pre-run, and they should also be on the folder there. So just make sure you download that whole folder and why is it not? Okay. Yeah, it's the CTMM _2_ home range. Should I make the colors brighter so it's easier to see the screen?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so everyone has the correct file? Okay.
So how do we load the AKDE.R data? What's the...
Okay, so here, I should have added it to the list. It's a package called here. Okay. If you don't have it, you'll have to install it. I should have added it on the... So you can run that to install it. Basically, it just makes it slightly easier instead of writing down like a file path. You can just write down, for example, the folder where things are and then the file. And it's, at least for me, it makes it easier to, if you're sharing with someone else, your code that can use very quickly and find the same files.
So where should we set the working directory? To the data?
Yeah, so if you have the NMU folder with that you get from here,
yes.
Right, and you set the CTMM folder as your working directory, and then that here function should work to get the outputs.
With reference to the CTMM?
Yeah, yeah, it would basically be reference to your working directory and start there, and when you, basically it's asking for where the outputs folder is, it will be within that working directory. Yeah. Okay, so
there's no such file directory.
Okay, and you tried to set the working directory for that. Okay. Have you set the working directory for the CTMM folder?
CTMM?
Yeah. And it's not working?
We're trying to restart hard to see if that fixes.
Okay.
I'll tell you in a minute.
Because what you can also do, at least just to check, is just do the function here and see what that shows up. I mean, my case will be different, but just make sure that whatever gets outputted with that function is the same working directory. If you're still having issues, let me know, and I can go check what the problem is. Okay, okay. Should we break for lunch now and then actually start so I'm not interrupting in the middle of the actual script? Okay, yeah, let's do that.